Hey, podcast listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Psychology of Games podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Madigan. It's my mission in life to dive into the psychology literature and come back with things that help you understand why games are designed how they are, why they're marketed and sold as they are, and why we gamers do what we do when we play them. In each episode of this podcast, I talk with an expert on the psychology of video games about a specific topic. This is the episode about harassment in video games. Let me just quickly remind you that if you go to psychologyofgames.com, you will be delighted to find hundreds of articles that I've written on the overlap between psychology and video games, as well as stacks of podcast episodes. You can find out how to subscribe to updates, follow me on Twitter and Facebook, how to support me on Patreon to keep more episodes and articles coming. You can even take a peek at my book on the psychology of video games called Getting Gamers, The Psychology of Video Games and Their Impact on the People Who Play Them. Okay, it's time we talked about harassment in video games. Maybe you've experienced it yourself. You're playing along in an online competitive game, having a good time, and you say something into team chat. Immediately, some nincompoop starts hurling snide or hysterical insults at you, either through voice chat or text. And they're not just garden variety trash talk. These are insults directly targeting your gender, or your race, or your age, or your sexual orientation. Heck, maybe all the above if it's a particularly bad run-on sentence. Or maybe you're browsing your favorite message boards or subreddits when you come across someone like you being made fun of in a similar way. Or even just some nasty comments thrown out there to an appreciative audience by someone who used to be your favorite Twitch or YouTube streamer. This is not a stretch. The universe's most popular YouTube star, PewDiePie, has recently gotten in trouble for off-the-cuff and premeditated racial slurs, and tens of millions of people listen to him when he does it. These are all bad experiences. Or worse, they're genuinely upsetting experiences that make you reconsider gaming as a hobby, or at least make you ditch the headset. So, if you don't call it quits altogether, you may mute chat, put away your mic, and go back to lurking instead of participating and sharing. You feel bad, you feel stressed, and you get pissed off. This actually strikes me as similar to stress and harassment in the workplace, which has been documented by organizational psychologists. In one 1997 study of sexual harassment in the workplace, researchers found that relative to other women, those who were harassed at work reported more stress, worse health, and dissatisfaction with their life in general. They were also absent from work more often and expressed more interest in quitting their jobs. It's not difficult to see how studies like these can be mapped onto other communities besides work, such as gaming communities, cons, and other online spaces. And so, given that this podcast is about the psychology of video games, we must eventually come to the question about what psychology can tell us about harassment in video games. What can various theories about social psychology, for example, tell us about under what conditions harassment's most likely to happen, what the consequences of harassment are for both the community and the target, and what game developers and other players can do to curb it. And what specifically have psychologists discovered about sexual harassment and similar misconduct in the context of video games when they've tried to study it? Is that something that people can even study? Going further, could we keep our eyes open to other academic fields like communications, sociology, organizational psychology, or even criminology to understand this phenomenon? These are the kinds of questions I will explore with my guest expert on this episode of the Psychology of Games podcast. Thanks again for joining us for the interview portion of the podcast. My guest this episode is Wai-Yun Tang, and he has been writing about psychology and video games for longer than even I have. He's been doing it since 2006, at least 2006-ish. His blog, vgresearcher.wordpress.com, has been a long-standing source of great information about academic research in video games, psychology, and communications. Last year, he finished his PhD in communications from Ohio State University, and he's the author of several peer-reviewed publications about gamer behaviors as they relate to topics like aggression, harassment, and helping others. He's currently a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Munster in Germany. Wai-Yun, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, like I said, you and I have been in communication for years at this point and kind of just exchanging emails and talking about this topic. And I think we've enjoyed each other's blogs and other writings quite a bit. So I'm glad to finally have you on the show. So you've been on my list for a while.
I have been expecting you.
Seems like I've talked to about half of your colleagues at least. Dr. Jesse Fox was one of your academic advisors, and it sounds like you're doing some work with Torsten Quandt, both of whom I've had on the podcast. So they have brought your name up and recommended I talk to you, and I said, oh, yeah, I know. I should get around to him. So I'm glad that you were able to join us. So what are you doing these days? What are you doing in Munster, at the University of Munster in Germany? And how'd you get there from Ohio, of all places?
So when I finished my PhD in communication from Ohio State University, I was looking for some jobs. And it was a good timing that Torsten Quandt was posted an opening in postdoctoral research at the University of Munster. So I was available. He was looking for someone, and it was just good timing, though. Really good timing. Really lucky, though, actually. So now here I am as a postdoc researcher doing some research, continuing my research on sexual harassment in video game and some research in virtual reality.
So yeah, I think your track and your career that you've taken is kind of fascinating and probably of interest to a lot of people who have been contacting me, because, you know, maybe once every couple of weeks I'll get an email from somebody who says, like, oh, psychology and video games, I didn't even know that was a thing. Like, I like both of those things. Or, you know, I'm an undergraduate, or I'm looking to find a graduate program to go into where I can do this, where I can marry psychology and video games. And you did that. I think your degree is in communications, but a lot of the stuff that you talk about definitely overlaps with the psychology field as well. So indeed, you're living that dream. You're doing it. So kind of walk me down how you got started down that path. Like, did you set out to marry these two topics, or did it just kind of happen? Like, what happened?
It's more like it kind of happened. So let me bring you back to 1999.
Okay.
Yes.
Time travel music.
Does anybody, I think most readers might not remember EverQuest. Mm-hmm. And yeah, some people in my age might remember that.
One of the original massively multiplayer online games, role-playing games.
Indeed. And the topic of addiction has been brought up quite early during that time. So that had got my interest in studying addiction in EverQuest. But by then, I was just a high schooler. Mm-hmm. So going forward into the 2000s, I studied psychology in my undergraduate years, and I just took random courses. And then I've heard of one particular person who did a seminal study. That person is Nick Yee. Yes.
Yeah.
He is quite influential, and he has influenced many people into studying video games as a academic field. So
yeah, and he kind of got into studying EverQuest when he was an undergraduate and then a graduate student as well. So, and he wrote a lot about avatars and the Proteus paradox, but then went on to talk about gamer motivation and a lot of different topics. So how did he influence you?
He publishes his studies on his website. If I remember, it was the Daedalus Project.
Mm-hmm.
And I read all the results, and it just motivated me to study video games as a purely academic subject. So I was kind of like in the middle of my undergraduate career, so I started to take classes that might be helpful in studying video games. So cognitive psychology, social psychology courses, one in addiction course. I was still feeling interested in addiction, but sometime later I just started to get bored of it, though. But yes. In 2007, that's when I started collecting peer-reviewed articles and started cataloging them. And that's where I started writing my blog. So vgresearcher.wordpress.com. I had, back at that time, wanted to take psychology of video games. But then again, I was just an undergraduate student, so I felt I did not have the right to have this blog name. So I just went something that.
So that's why I was able to get the blog, the URL, huh?
Mm-hmm. Indeed. You were a PhD back then. You had the expertise. You had the knowledge. So you deserve the right, in my mind, to have that website.
I don't know about that. I just do things and tend to ask for forgiveness afterwards if they don't work out. But I appreciate it.
Ah, indeed. So So I drank that time. So I felt I felt that my goal is to get a PhD in fugging studies. So I did not know if it was, at the time, I thought it was about in psychology. So I did whatever I could do to get into graduate school. So I volunteered at research labs from professors in the psychology department, did some studies of my own, surveys. If you look at my own mold studies from undergrad, it's a bit embarrassing, but that's
they always are.
And that's the pain of growing up. Yeah, and eventually I got the attention of some professors at other universities, so I managed to get into graduate school at Ohio State University under tutelage of Dr. Brad Bushman, my advisor.
Dr. Bushman is well known for his research on psychology and video games, especially around the topic of violent media and violent games, right?
Indeed. Yep. Indeed. Under the tutelage of someone super famous in the field. So during grad school, I lost interest in addiction, so I moved on to something else. I was looking into media violence and self-control, how willpower might affect aggressive behaviors. So that was my master's thesis. And then a few years later, I kind of changed directions. And so I was still going on my research program on willpower and violent video games. And that's when, in 2012, is when I started doing research on sexual harassment. Now, this is an interesting story for such how I got into sexual harassment. So, in 2012 is when there was an event that happened that was on Kotaku, on many video game news, is when there was a female player who was sexually harassed live stream. So I believe that was called the cross assault incident.
Was that the one in the fighting game community?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. That thought that ringed a bell.
Mm-hmm, indeed. And then I believe there was some other sexual harassment event incidences during that same year. And if I recall correctly, so my memory is a bit fuzzy since it was 5 years ago, is I think some incidences has happened with Anita Sarkeesian. I think it was with her video game tropes.
Women versus tropes in video games, I think it was.
So with all these incidences, I was finishing up my master's. Cool. Now I can do my PhD. I have more time. So I felt like, you know, I could do multiple projects, do all the projects all the time.
All the projects.
But sexual harassment was supposed to be a side project. But what motivated me to do sexual harassment is I was tired of waiting for someone to publish a sexual harassment article. It's like I was keeping up with all the art, with all the publications in the literature, and I kind of expected an article on sexual harassment to come up around this time. So I got tired of waiting and just went into Dr. Jesse Fox's office and said, "Jesse, let's do it. Let's do a study on sexual harassment in video games." And the rest is history, more or less. But my prediction was a few months late. And in early 2013, there was a paper that was published by Jeffrey Kuznetkov and Lindsay Rose that got a lot of attention somehow. That they did a field experiment that they found that female players received 3 times the number of negative comments than their male players compared to their male players.
Is that via like text chat or voice chat?
I believe it was through voice chat.
Yeah, I think I remember that paper.
Yeah, so that's where I headed. So I switched directions towards more and more to the sexual harassment route than the willpower. So it's incredible how during your time in graduate school, in a few years, people change directions.
Yeah, well, that's what being a student is about, right? Is learning what the possibilities are, learning what interests you, learning what your capabilities are, and then picking something out. So let's move on to the topic of harassment and sexism in video games, which is kind of the main topic of this conversation that I wanted to have. And you're obviously interested in that, I would call you an expert on that. You've done a lot of reading and researching and asking questions of your own. But I think that there's kind of an elephant in the room that we should probably bring up first, thing that most people are thinking. Like me, you're a dude, you're a guy. So what makes you an expert on this topic, and what right do two guys like us have sitting here and talking about it?
Well, unfortunately, there isn't much of a list of experts yet. Like, look around. My name is the list, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But hopefully in the future, there will be a larger list, or maybe if I look more broadly, there may be other experts I'm not aware of. But yeah, I mean, what right do I have? Well, that depends on the perspective we take. If we take the metagaming perspective, I have devoted study points to the sexual harassment literature. I have spent hours reading the information. I have slain a dissertation for sexual harassment literature under difficult circumstances.
Yeah.
Published a few studies.
That's like a world boss.
Yeah, it is a world boss. A very, very big world boss before getting their PhD.
Yeah.
And, of course, buying a very expensive armor that you can only use once in a lifetime, which is the graduation robes. But I published a few studies on sexual harassment, so these completed quests would have at least given me an achievement of an expert in that field.
There you go.
Expert,
I agree.
But not grand expert, not lead expert, but at least expert.
Yeah.
But from another point of view, some would say we don't, because we don't all have certain quality or trait, whatever that might be. But personally, what is right for us, Jamie, me, is that we are two guys discussing it, and we are open to this discussion on the best available information we have on sexual harassment. Now, this information is the least wrong we have. It is not the right answer, because we can create better tools over time, and that information will become updated. So old information will be outdated, but what we have is the best we have, the most we should have. So if you have people saying that the information we have right now is wrong, and there's nothing to improve it, like no suggestion, just say it's all wrong, they're just throwing flaming straws.
Yeah.
So if it is a good right or not, that is up to the audience, up to the listeners.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that, you know, specifically in this context, we're talking about the academic/scientific study of harassment in communities, right? So we're not just talking about the topic of harassment in general. Obviously, there are many experts, many of them unwilling experts on the topic of sexual harassment and other kinds of harassment. But you and I are specifically talking like, well, when people sit down to study this in a very controlled scientific, you know, way, what do we know? What have we found, and so forth? And definitely sounds like that's a conversation that we can have, despite the fact that we may have different perspectives. And like you, you know, if anybody wants to share those perspectives, they can certainly do that. There's comment sections and emails and so forth. So that said, I guess let's just start at the base level and you know, how are sexism and harassment defined in academic studies and academic literature? Like, what does it mean to say that someone is harassing or been harassed?
Let's start with sexism, because sexism would later define or help contextualize harassment, sexual harassment. So sexism, and this is me reciting someone's definition of sexism, is that it can be defined as an individual's beliefs and behaviors and organizational practices that either harm individuals based on upon their gender, or contribute to the maintenance of gender inequality in the society at large. So this is not just looking sexism at women, but also sexism at different genders. So maybe someone identifies as transgender. So
right.
This is kind of open. But then again, when we talk about sexism and sexual harassment, definitions can be not definite. It's not as easy to define it like aggression, justice. What is justice? What is the definite justice? What is the definition of morality? What is love? No one can end that definition down. If you have two philosophers, they'll be arguing for hours.
They'll have four or five definitions. Yeah.
Four or five definitions, 10 hours. So I'm just going to stick with one person definition. from one expert who wrote a book chapter on that, and I'll just be satisfied with that until a new update definition comes up.
Okay. So since this is a podcast where we talk about psychology and psychological theories and how they impact player behaviors and game design and so forth, what are some of the psychological theories that might help explain why harassment in video games happens?
So one of the psychological theories I most subscribe to is one within the social identity approach. So the specific theory is the social identity model of de-individuation effects. So this model posits that when you are in an anonymous, when you are in an environment where you are anonymous, where you are personally anonymous, so being in a crowd, being online, where your name is not being shown, where your personal identity to others is unknown, then you don't have an identity. So you seek out into the environment what social cues, clues, signs of what this identity, this group is. So who the others are. So you look around and see, who is this person? Who is that? Who am I with? So in video games, this general identity is gamer. So think of a mental image of a gamer. So what do you think? What would be the image of a mental, what would be the mental image of a gamer? It would be a male, maybe possibly a straight male gamer. So you have this mental image of the straight male gamer. So that defines your identity and influences your behaviors within that environment. So if you are playing in a video game, then you identify as a gamer. So maybe a specific video game, and let's not name any specific video game, so we'll just keep it in general, then it would influence you what your behaviors are going to be like in that specific game. And with that mental image of a gamer, it would help you identify who you are. So, women gamers don't exactly share the mental spotlight as much as a male gamer, unfortunately. So, if you think about gamer, it tends towards the male rather than both genders. So, women, for some gamers, women are not really gamers. Actually gamers. So sometimes they might call them fake girl gamers or fake gamers. Right. So they start behaving to non-gamers like noobs and women gamers with hostility or with other behaviors. So what would gamer treat outsiders with hostility? Usually with hostility. That's the social identity model of the individuation effects, is how you behave online in a video game and where your identity is assumed this general social identity that is gamer.
Right. Yeah, kind of what I like about the de-individuation model is that you're right. Like when people feel that they're part of a crowd and they don't have an identity and they start looking to the environment for cues, and one of the things they'll pick up on, like you said, is the stereotype of a gamer. Like, that's how I should behave. But a lot of other games are very, like, competitive, almost by definition. They involve acts of aggression and war themes and all those sort of things. So those sort of social cues can help people get the idea that, okay, this sort of like verbal harassment or verbal aggression is okay because it's baked into the context of the situation. And if I'm looking for clues on how I should be behaving, then here's a big red flashing one that I can pick up on. So what else? What else you got? What other kind of psychology theories might help us understand why harassment happens?
So there's another theory I'd like to comment on, and it is called the online disinhibition effect. So this one has been proposed above by John Siller, and it was published in 2004, so right around the same time of this one interesting penny arcade comic titled The Greater Internet Fuckwad Theory. So that theory proposes that when a normal person is anonymous with an audience, they become a total fuckwad. Now, the issue is with that theory, with this online disinhibition effect, is why women are more proportionally targeted than men do. Theory does not say anything about women targeted or sexual minorities, for example, or for a fact, being more often targeted than others. So this one does lacks any explanatory or lacks mm-hmm. any predictive power in explaining why women are more targeted.
Okay. Yeah, I'm familiar with the online disinhibition effect, but it doesn't seem like there's been a lot of actual research done on that. It was put out there and it sort of made sense, and it suggested yeah. studies that one could do and hypotheses that one can test. But, you know, when I went out there and started trying to search for peer-reviewed research on it, I didn't find much.
Yeah, it just kind of pops up once in a while, well, quite rarely, and someone from the same author, not John Siller, but someone else. I kept forgetting the name, but it's not as well studied and it's not as well tested as the social identity model of the individuation effect. So the side model has been quite tested a lot, and I think has gone a few revisions of its own.
Yeah, it's evolved a bit. Yeah, but I mean, some of those ideas around like desynchronization of communication, you know, it's not two-way or there's pauses between communication. So, you know, somebody who says something, they might not see how it affects the other person, or they might not get an immediate reaction from the other person. Right. Seems like it could contribute to that, or at least the idea that like, oh, well, like I'm not getting blowback from this, or I'm not really hurting a person because I don't have any evidence that, you know, they're hurt or that they aren't just taking it in stride or considering it all in good fun, when that may not be the truth. And there may be, you know, other reasons or other ways that it hurts the person or hurts the situation. That stuff does sort of make sense. So what about, you know, this idea of considering ourselves a gamer and tying like our identity as a person to this idea of being someone who plays video games? How does that all tie in?
This is very interesting, though. And we got some recent data, but I'll talk about that later. So this is quite interesting, is how when our identity as gamer defines us and what we think of what the gamer ideal is. So if we think back about this mental image of gamer, is this male, straight male, maybe white, or maybe something like that. But there's this idea of a male gamer. And when you meet someone who does not meet this ideal, you might feel some apprehension that this does not conform to your identity, to your sense of gamer. So like, what is this? This is a woman. I don't think she's a gamer. Who is she? She's an outsider. So that kind of feels like a social identity threat. Mm-hmm. That this is your sense of self, your sense of social identity, that who that defines who you are. So that's one way to see is that how it ties in with this identity, that this identity has been threatened by an outsider who wants to be included into this gamer identity. And this gamer identity, this real actual gamer identity, does not match your ideal gamer identity.
Yeah, and we know from a long tradition of social psychology that people don't need much to sort of trigger that. Well, they're an outsider, and I'm an insider, and thus, like, I don't like them. Like that yes. person is different from me in one core way, or even some non-core way, or my in-group, and it's sort of "quote unquote natural" for humans to view outsiders with not as kindly as they do people within their own sort of reference group. So how do these ideals, this ideal image of a gamer, like how does that develop, or how did that develop? And how, I guess, embedded in that question is how might it change?
Well, how is it embedded? It's like that would be related to cultivation theory. Multitude of factors. So the media's depiction of gamers, the number of the people you encounter as gamers, so people who identify publicly as gamers, online, in person, in the media, fiction or nonfiction. So it would give you an idea of what's the percentage of people who are gamers or male, gives you an idea of what is being like a gamer. So there are a lot of information, so both from the media, online, and in person, that develops this idea of a mental image of a gamer over a long term. So that's how it's embedded. So
it's information that they've picked up by looking at like the media, so like magazines and YouTube and streamers and people around them, that they assume that what they see is representative of what is in the wider population and in the wider world, right? Okay. So how might that change in the future? Because, you know, the stats that I'm familiar with say that about half, maybe a little less than half of gamers are female, and that older people, including older women, play games, and younger, and there is a lot more diversity and a lot more variety in the types of people that play games. So how do these stereotypes persist in the face of information like that?
Well, when we're talking about stereotypes, sometimes people might be selective in the information they get. So maybe they're more selective in what they want to accept. Maybe some people are more selective in the information they receive. So maybe they don't accept some information that do not conform to their stereotypes, and they only accept to information that confirms that stereotype. So maybe YouTube videos that shows girl gamers, stereotypical girl gamers, rather than those girl gamers who are portrayed more realistically. Mm-hmm. So that's one way that stereotype exists, is because they like that information that fits their stereotype. So changing people's stereotype is pretty hard, though.
Yeah, it unfortunately is. So yeah, they tend to, you know, humans and our squishy brains tend to have confirmatory information biases, like you said. So we pay attention to what confirms our stereotypes and our pre-held convictions, and we ignore or downplay the importance of information that does the opposite. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like the whole idea of identity as a gamer, I think is kind of interesting. And I've got one pet theory about that as well, is that, you know, we invest a lot in this hobby, right? So you want to build a gaming PC that's going to cost hundreds or thousands of dollars even. A new console is going to run you several hundred dollars, not to mention the TV to play it on. And games are $60 a pop, and then they try to squeeze you further for microtransactions and all this sort of stuff. So we invest a lot of money and we invest a lot of time in this hobby, and it becomes part of our identity as well. So there's, you know, studies that show that the more time and effort that you invest in something, the more central it becomes to your person, to your sense of self and your sense of identity. And we don't like it when somebody comes along and attacks our identity, right? So we conflate what it is to be a gamer with what it is to be us. And when somebody comes and says, hey, you're treating this group of people badly in the gaming space, you know, as a gamer, like, I'm going to attack that, then that starts to feel like an attack on our personal identity. And we react like we often do when we're attacked. You know, we defend ourselves, we counterattack, we try to do what we can to hold on to that picture that has served us so well and made us so happy. You know, this idea of what a gamer is and the fact that we are one. And so we sort of react disproportionately to those criticisms, which may not even be meant as attacks, but even just observations or, you know, like, hey, here's something that's bad about something that is, you know, almost universally good or in general good. Here's one bad aspect to it. We react sort of out of proportion to that sort of quote unquote attack. And that reaction may involve downplaying that information. It may involve attacking that person, harassing that person, or creating a culture or a shared understanding that it's acceptable for other people to do those things and we won't object to it, that type of stuff. Does that make any sense to you, or am I just making stuff up?
Right on point. Right on point.
Hooray! glad to hear it.
Yes.
Okay, so on the topic of psychological phenomena, psychological theories that may help explain why harassment happens. Anything else to add? Anything else that we know or might look at? Or
to quote a fictional scientist,
the best kind.
Eyes open, beer. From a scientist in Star Trek Voyager. Okay. So always keep your eyes and ears open for other theories, especially from fields outside your own field. So someone in communication did a study on sexual harassment and used a theory from criminology. So this theory called routine activity theory, and this paper was just published in a conference this year. So it's a criminological theory, and it focuses on circumstances in which criminal acts occur instead of looking at the perpetrators. So the circumstances of exposure to past behavior, so exposure to past sexual harassment behaviors, target suitability, and lacking guardianship. So if you have those three factors, that you have seen sexual harassment behavior, then you have a target that is suitable, an easy target that you could harass, and you have no guardianship, so no moderators around, then the chances of sexual harassment are likely to increase with those three factors. So that is an interesting theory, and the data was quite interesting. So eyes open to other theories. I mean,
yeah.
It's pretty interesting. So,
yeah, I love it when that sort of cross-pollination happens, where you have different fields sort of looking at the same problem or borrowing models and yanking them into a different context. That's great.
I mean, you don't need to be creative by being original. You just mix and mash.
Mm-hmm.
My dissertation was like that. I was mixing, matching video games and sexual harassment and see what happens. So that's creativity to you here. It's just mixing, remixing stuff. And that's all right. That's all right.
So what are the consequences of all this? Like, when harassment happens and when you have those types of cultures and toxic behavior towards women or other groups, what happens? What are the outcomes?
Yeah, well, first, I'd like the listener to refer to one of the earlier podcasts, the one with toxic behaviors, the one you interviewed Jeffrey Lin. But from my standpoint, from my vantage point here with the data I have, and this is just current data, is that one of the consequences that when you're in a toxic environment, when you are being exposed to something that you don't like, something harmful, so one of the actions is that you're more likely to withdraw because you don't want to stick around being harmed by other players, so you withdraw. So you get out of the game, you quit the game, you find some other game that is less harmful to you. But those effects might stick with you. Now, we don't have the data, so we don't have the data, but according to the literature in sexual harassment literature, is that what they found is that the potential harmful physical effects for gamers suffering from sexual harassment or harassment, potentially, is that they must suffer headaches, nausea, respiratory, digestive, and sleeping problems.
Those sound like reactions to general stress, so that, yeah, I'm not surprised.
I mean, you are being harmed. Your brain would release some chemical. Your brain might have some chemical reactions that would affect the rest of your body. Sticks and stones will hurt. And what's the other?
Yeah, sticks and stones may break my bones, and words can also hurt, or something along those lines.
Something along that line. Oh, I'm bad at quoting that. That's funny.
Oh, that's good.
But not just physical symptoms, but psychological symptoms as well. So the potential ones we might be looking for is anxiety, depression, sadness, lowered self-esteem, maybe at worst, post-traumatic stress disorder, symptoms of those. So this is the potential, this is what we might be looking at in the future, as soon as I get my study underway.
Get your funding, yeah.
Yeah. Or if anybody, I mean, I'm okay if someone else does it. I mean, I'm only one person with two measly hands. So anyone can do this. Or, you know, we could work together, collaborate.
Yeah, you guys could collaborate. Yeah, there you go.
Like, we have a laundry list, and I need someone to help me out with that. So another potential consequence is that women and other empathetic players are less likely to identify themselves as gamers. Like, Why do I want to be as a gamer if other gamers harass other women and they might harass me? So that does not fit your personal identity. So people who witness these kinds of sexual harassment behaviors are turned off from being identifying as gamers. So that's one potential consequence and outcome. So that's pretty much what I have here, there are probably some more potential consequences, but I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of the sexual harassment literature.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of great research to be done there. And like you said, you could probably borrow from research that's done on workplace harassment, for example, which is a lot of research has been done there, and they've measured effects on things like productivity and stress levels and general happiness and withdrawal symptoms. So like, you know, quitting your job or taking a transfer somewhere else. I bet a lot of those theories and methodologies would map over pretty well.
Indeed. I mean, there's a lot of similarities between the workplace and video games. Think about MMOs. Think about EVE Online. EVE Online players might feel that they're just working, that they're doing a second job, and they're dealing with the problems that they deal, the same problems that they deal in the workplace. So there's a lot of similarities between playing a group, in a guild, in a clan, and working mm-hmm. in a workplace.
So there's probably a lot of effects on the people who are the targets of that harassment. What about the rest of us and the larger community? Like, what happens when harassment happens in a group that I'm part of, even if I don't participate in it? Like, what happens to me and what happens to that community?
So it creates the impression that the environment and the players in it see such behaviors as normal, that this is a toxic, hostile work environment. But it is acceptable, and some might feel compelled to emulate those behaviors in order to fit in. They may not like it, but they might be compelled to do it in order to fit in. Now, some others may not like it and want to get away from this toxic environment. So they'll just go transfer to another department, transfer to another server, another lobby, just want to get away, but they don't do anything. But another point is they're less likely to spend time in that particular video game if this toxic environment is everywhere. So everyone has a breaking point, and not everyone can grow a thick skin, or not everyone with a thick skin, and there's no one with a thick skin.
There's no infinitely thick skin, right?
Yeah, no infinitely thick skin.
They might withdraw, they might engage in that type of behavior, they may just generally be bummed out that, yes, you know, that their community has come to this. And then, you know, you see a lot of times where they might have the fire hose turned on them if they stick up for a person or try to speak out against that kind of behavior. So they may become targets as well.
Indeed. So if you stick up to them, if you stand up, you might get the same treatment as the victim. So you might get harassed. So some might call you a white knight because you're helping a woman, but just because she's a woman and all that stuff. But yeah, some people try to set tone of the environment. So they're trying to set the tone in the bar that is a rowdy, masculine locker room environment.
So how do we fix this problem? I realize that that's a big ask, right? That's a big question. So feel free to break off pieces of that or just offer things up as suggestions. But, you know, I think a lot of people listening are like, well, what do we do? What can game developers do? What can community managers do? And what can players do?
Big question. How do we fix this problem? From my vantage point, from my own ivory tower of a social identity model, I have two academic studies that kind of fits with my perspective. I mean, there are other perspectives, but, you know. So one study from Joseph Searing at Carnegie Mellon University did some real experiment using Twitch, and it shaped pro and antisocial behaviors. Now remember, users are anonymous, so they look to others for clues, how to behave, how to act. So when you have users who are clearly identified, but they have status, so someone who is, say, channel owner, the moderator, they are the ones who have been there for quite a while, so they know how to act within that environment. So think about Twitch, moderators, subscribers, channel owners, these are those with high status, and they are the ones who set the tone in how people behave. Mm-hmm. So other users start imitating their behaviors. So if the high status users behave antisocially, the other users follow along. If they behave pro-socially, the other users follow along. So users look to others in how to behave. So in a random environment, though, so maybe one bad apple, people will start following this bad apple, and then the cycle of bad toxic behaviors keep cycling in and out and out. So having a control on those behaviors, setting a tone, your own tone, can set antisocial behaviors and geared it towards more pro-social behaviors. So they like to...
That's great. That's real practical. That's great to hear, because it's pretty easy to enact, you would think, relative to some other possible solutions.
Yeah. So sometimes some behaviors may not be controlled. So, you know, moderation can help too. So banning some behaviors, some user for the behaviors can stop those behaviors. So, use banning strategically. Mm-hmm. So interestingly, another study that did the same thing, quite interestingly. So Kevin Munger, I'll post the link. So he did something similar with Twitter users. So he found that if you have white Twitter users with a high following accounts, with high followers, they are very effective in deterring racist tweets from white users in relation compared to black Twitter users. So when you have someone from your own group telling you that's not good, then you are likely to follow their advice. So I think using the power of group social identity, from my perspective, is one way to fix the problem. One way among many, but there are multiple theories, various theories that can help out.
Yeah, and again, taking it back to the organizational psychology literature, when we've done research on culture in organizations, which is, you know, the shared understanding of what types of behavior are acceptable and what types are going to get you punished. Yeah, I very clearly found that there's a disproportionate impact from leadership, especially like senior leaders who are sort of at the top of the organizational chart. They have a very strong impact on shaping that culture, and because they're sort of the most public, they're the most visible, they're the ones that people who, when they start talking, they'll pause and listen. So I can see that mapping onto, having like moderators and high status people in the community stepping up and trying to actively shape that culture instead of just kind of sitting back and hoping that it forms on its own.
Indeed. In relation to authority figures, is that influential gamers in the gaming community are also important. Like, try to think of a video game celebrity or a YouTuber who plays video games. They have a lot of people listening to them, and seeing them stand up to sexual harassment creates a huge impression on them. So it would help the gaming community immensely. So these role models for gamers have a huge influence, and they should be mindful of what they say or do online. Mm-hmm. They would have a lot of people who would imitate them. So they have to be mindful of that. But they have a potential role, a positive potential role, in helping out other gamers.
So are there any good examples of that kind of thing, or good examples of game developers and community managers that you'd like to point out as having done a good job in that area? Or in combating harassment in general?
I'm afraid of my knowledge of gaming community is rather poor compared to the academic research. That's a problem with the whole academia. So as far as I know, Riot Games have developed methods in tackling toxic behaviors, as you had introduced yesterday about a few years ago. But I don't remember who, or I could not find in that library, but someone proposed an industry-wide policy of toxic behaviors, that all games should have this policy that is standard across all video games.
Like a code of conduct, or?
A code of conduct, yes.
Okay.
I don't remember who. It could be the same person. It might be Jeffrey Lin, but it could be someone else, though. Or maybe I'm just making it up, but that's a problem of memory, though. But think of an analogy. If you have one bar that doesn't deal with rowdy behaviors, those bar patrons would continue their behavior in other bars, ruining other bar patrons' experiences. So it's vital to have same to have a standard set of rules across video games so that no one has to deal with the same problems all the time.
So what would be your dream study? Like, say you got like a huge grant and sort of money wasn't necessarily an obstacle. What would you do to study this problem?
Ooh. A longitudinal survey study. I would love to have a panel of gamers, a nationally representative panel of gamers, and ask them certain, send them surveys, different kinds of surveys that would answer different kinds of questions. So perpetration, their personality, victimization over the long term, see what kind of video game policies that would work, would not work. So also kind of like a long-term experiment, so implementing a policy here, what kind of video games they play, what is the most toxic video games, what is the least toxic video games. So a longitudinal panel study. I would follow a huge group, a nationally representative set of gamers, and just follow them with surveys. That would be my dream study. It would take years, but
yeah,
it's going to be worth it.
Yeah, the longitudinal studies are sadly underrepresented, you know, in the literature. There's not enough of them because they are expensive and difficult to do.
Yeah, very expensive. I mean, I would love to start a crowdfund, but who knows if it works out.
Yeah. So a couple of questions I always like to ask to close things out. Have you been playing anything lately? Have you had time to play any video games?
Not time, but whenever I have the time, I binge on them. So I've been playing...
What was your most recent binge? Yeah.
It's a game called Dust and Elysian Tale. I bought it like years ago, and it has been in my backlog, so I've been tackling my backlog on my Steam account. So that's what it is.
But that's like the side-scrolling platformer with like really great animation, isn't it?
Yes. It was a good game. Yeah.
I think I started it and played for a few hours and then got distracted by some other new shiny, which is usually how it goes on Steam.
So, yeah, I've been trying to deal with my Steam backlog and trying to dig myself out of it, though. So
yeah.
That's what I've been playing lately.
I finally got to the point where another Steam sale comes around and I look at everything and I either already own it and haven't played it yet, or I just say like, okay, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to play this if I buy it. I'm not going to play it, you know, before the next Steam sale when I can probably just pick it up then. And it's ridiculous when stuff is like, you know, $5, $8. I'm pretty bad at impulse purchasing that sort of stuff, or I have been in the past.
Yeah, I feel the same thing. And now when it comes to Steam sales, I ask my question. It's not about the cost, is do I have the time? Will I commit that time? If not, I'll just put it on the wish list, and that wish list gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah, except now I get like emails every couple of days saying an item on your Steam wish list is on sale, because now my wish list is like huge. October is going to be rough for me. And actually, this podcast is going up in October, but we're recording it a little ahead of that. But that's when the big holiday release schedule kicks in for me, and there's a lot of big AAA games coming out, like Shadow of Wardor and the new Assassin's Creed game and the new Wolfenstein game. There's just a lot. Destiny 2 for the PC will be out in October, which I'm interested in. Yeah. So it's going to be rough, but I'm kind of like between games right now. So I just kind of going back and catching up on some stuff and trying out some free-to-play games here and there. I did just recently finish... what was it called? Agents of Mayhem, which is basically the next Saints Row game.
Oh, yes. I've been wanting to try that game.
Maybe. Are you a fan? Are you a fan of the Saints Row games?
I am a fan of the Saints Row games. I mean, the first game was number 3, and I've been a big fan ever since. So number 4, Get Out of Hell. I mean, it's so much fun, a lot of humor, and it's great satire though. But number 3 is my favorite because I get to drive quite like I get to drive in a city and
Yeah, they're great games. I've been playing them since the second one. And then, yeah, I think I'm with you. Like, things really hit their stride in Saints Row the Third, and then they got even crazier in the fourth, and then they kind of rebooted everything to do this Agents of Mayhem. So it's like the same, a lot of the same characters. So you got like Johnny Gat, and you've got, you know, the Saints Row purple fleur-de-lis like shows up everywhere, but it's kind of G.I. Joe mixed with Saints Row. And which spoke to me because, you know, when I was a kid, I watched a lot of Saturday morning cartoons, and G.I. Joe and Transformers were some of my favorites to watch in the afternoons after school. So I enjoyed it. The game Agents of Mayhem kind of peters out. There's a lot of repetition and it's kind of overly long, and there's not as much variety as there should be. But I just love the packaging and the presentation and the whole sort of spirit of the thing really clicked with me, and I enjoyed it quite a lot. But I finished that a couple of weeks ago. So, I'm clearing my plate, getting ready for this holiday season to jump into some big AAA games and spend many hours playing those. So, well, where can people go on the internet to find out more about you and your work?
Yes. Well, you can find me more. I'm more active on Twitter, so at @WY_Tang. So you would see me tweeting the most recent study, the one that I think is Twitter worthy, if it's a word. But but I'm quite active, and you can always tweet at me, and I might respond in a short amount of time. As for my blog, it's on hiatus. I just don't know when I'll get back to it, though. I mean, the scars of my dissertation haven't healed, so and the longer I wait, the tougher it is to get back. So yeah. I don't know when I'll get back to it.
Okay. So Twitter, and that's probably the best way to get a hold of you. And I'll put links up to all that and with the show notes, the blog post that goes with this episode of the podcast. But thanks very much for coming on. This is a great discussion and important discussion. And it sounds like there's a lot of good research to be had on this topic as things go forward and sort of as the demographics of gaming and game players continue to change and evolve, that there will be a need for it to understand what's happening and how to kind of shape those communities as well. So I very much appreciate your coming on.
Ah, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. You reached the end of another episode. If you haven't already, go to psychologyofgames.com to subscribe to the podcast and check out all the articles I've written over the years. Like all of them, this episode of the podcast was written, produced, and hosted by just me. So if you enjoy them, you might also consider supporting me on Patreon. That's patreon.com/POG. There's also a hard-to-miss link for doing that on psychologyofgames.com. Thanks, and I'll talk to you next episode.